Here we are in Isaiah chapter 10, and we're going to be, Lord willing, finishing verses 24 through 32 tonight. Isaiah chapter 10, verses 24 through 32. Certainly our desire is to, first of all, go into the Word of God and find out what it says. And then the second thing we ask ourselves is, well, what does that mean? That's where we find the principle, by the way. Use that phrase, principalize the text, find the principle of the passage. We're going to be looking for the principle together in this. And, so I think it's one of the advantages. We have actually an advantage tonight of being a little bit smaller, because when you're a little bit smaller, you can communicate a little bit better, and that's good. So we'll take this as an advantage. It's a good thing. So we're going to be looking for the principle, and then ultimately, how does that apply to me? Application. If you don't get to the application, what was all the work for? Our desire is to certainly get that far. It's a great passage. Actually, verses 28 through 32 seems to be some sort of prose or some sort of perhaps song that was even sung, but certainly from the hand of God that was to encourage the nation, more specifically of Judah, and to help them focus on God's just and righteous indignation as well as his vindication. And so we're going to be looking at verses 28 through 32 in particular, but sort of taking a running start and beginning with verse 24 through 27. Last week, one of the questions that I asked you was about fear in your life and the things that you fear. And if we just take a minute, and I don't necessarily want you to tell me your fear, but if you could just give me a fear that we oftentimes battle with. What would be one particular kind of fear that we often wrestle with? Yes?
Not being able to support your family.
Okay. Would you say that would be under finances?
Yes, sir.
All right. So we have a fear of making enough money. Finances is a biggie. Anything else?
Health.
Health?
Yes.
Health, that's a biggie, too. Health is a biggie. Yes. Teacher?
Future.
Oh, future. I was afraid of teachers. Future. Yeah, future's a big one. Most of mine did. I'm sorry?
Death.
Like dying. I hate to tell you, but that's probably in your future.
That's a definite.
That probably wasn't encouraging, was it? That didn't help, did it? That's one of the big fears, financing, health, future death. All right, now what we're going to do is we're going to look at some of these particular fears and see how some of these, how this principle pans out with those particular issues. And, you know, if you want to throw in another one, we'll throw in another one later on. But we're gonna see how this particular passage really applies to this. As God says and gives a commandment, do not be afraid. This is a commandment that is repeated throughout Scripture. God does not want you to be afraid. It is a command. It is not an option. It is not something that you say to yourself, well, maybe I'll get around to it. God says that if you continue in fear, you are sinning against Him, disobeying Him, and not trusting in Him. So where there is fear, there is no trust. Yes?
So just to be clear, the Syrians are descending from the north at this point. God says, do not be afraid.
Do not be afraid.
Okay, good.
Right. And if you back up into chapter 7, before it was the Assyrians, it was the Syrians and Israel. And if you look in Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 3, we'll pick up in verse 3, the Lord said to Isaiah, go now and meet Ahaz. He's certainly telling them to meet him at the end of the road with the highway, the area actually where these people are coming down in the Fuller's Field, and say to him, verse 4, take care, be calm, have no fear, and just in case you don't know what that entails, you cannot be faint-hearted. And then you go to chapter 8, and he states this in verse 12, you are not to say, verse 12, it is a conspiracy in regard to all that this people call conspiracy. And what he's talking about is when these things begin to unfold and you begin to see more specifically the Syrians being swallowed up by the Assyrians, and you see all of the hope and all the trust that you put yourself in begin to fall beneath you, you're not to say, well, that was just something that man did. He says, that was me. And he says, he goes on and says, and you are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. Did you catch that? Verse 12. You are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. Or more specific, I think you could put be terrified. You could put in there tremble. It's actually probably the root word. You're not allowed to shake. You can't tremble. You can't be terrified. You can't dread these things or the same thing. Literally what God is saying is you can't be afraid of the same thing the world's afraid of. Now, are we to be afraid of something? Yes, we're to be afraid of God. And I know oftentimes people say, well, that's a different kind of fear. No, it's not. And we'll talk about this as we go, but it is literally to tremble and even dread God in that sense. Now, we know that there's a reverence that comes along with that. But knowing who he is and his great, and if you just read with me in verse 13, that's explained. It says in verse 13, it is the Lord of hosts whom you should regard as holy, and he shall be your fear, and he shall be your what?
Dread.
Yeah. So he's making it clear that no other should they fear but God alone. And you cannot fear the same things that the world fears. Now, if we were to kind of go down the list of finances, health, future, death, those are all things that the world fears. You're not allowed to be afraid of those. You're actually not allowed. Not an option. This can't be. And so when he comes in Isaiah chapter 10 and he states to them, in clearly the Assyrians are coming and attacking, getting ready to attack and coming up to the neck, so to speak. He says in verse 24, therefore, thus says the Lord, the God of hosts, O my people who dwell in Zion, do not fear the Assyrian who strikes you with a rod and lifts up his staff against you the way Egypt did. Why is he given that analogy? Because Egypt was not allowed to swallow up his people. They were allowed to beat him, but they couldn't swallow up his people. And he is literally saying, and they're going to have to let you go just like Egypt did, because I was just using them to discipline you. But the passage is real clear that we're dealing with an issue of fear, and what's going to be unfolding in this passage is not only the fact that you and I should not be afraid, but it's going to take us down the path of where fear leads us and why we shouldn't be afraid, why it is such a commandment that it is. And so as we go on, we're going to see this thing. He goes on and says in verse 25, for in a very little while my indignation against you will be spent. Now his point is clear, that though it's the Assyrians that are attacking, he's the one wielding the rod, right? I mean, you back up into verse 15, and he says, is the axe to boast over the one who chops with it? And he's talking about the axe boasting being Assyria. And he says Assyria is bragging over the fact that they're doing all these stuff, all these things, but I'm the one that's doing it. They have a certain intent to destroy you, but I'm only going to use them to discipline you. They're not in control, I am. And the more you and I understand that God is sovereign and that he's in control, then we begin to direct our fear appropriately, not according to the world, but we begin to fear God and ultimately then reverence him. We're going to talk about how these two are inextricably tied. But if you back up into chapter 10, now in verse 26, it says, and the Lord of hosts will arouse a scourge against him. Against who, by the way? The Assyrians, right. He's using the Assyrians. He's just about done with them. I'm going to use them up to a point, and then I'm going to rise up a scourge against them. And he gives an example, like the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb. Anybody know what that's talking about? We've kind of alluded to this in past studies. What is he talking about? Why is he giving this particular analogy, I guess is my question. Anybody want to jump in on that one?
What are you saying on the Midianites? Wasn't it just a complete mayhem? Or?
Yeah, there was a mayhem. That particular story comes out of the book of Judges. It comes out of particular as you're going into Judges 6 and 7. And, of course, Gideon was called for this particular war. And you remember the whole scenario. Gideon does not see himself as a warrior, although his name means such. But the angel has declared, you've been called for this purpose, and you're going to be a warrior whether you want to or not. So God enlists him. I guess it would be the first draft. And God enlists Gideon, and he says, let's go. And I don't know if you followed the particular story. Gideon is called to tear down the altars. And of course, his dad has his altars. And instead of tearing them down in the daytime, he tears them down at night. So he's not really super confident in all these things. And he's the one that keeps laying out. I hear people say, I'm going to lay out a fleece. Well, I just want to let you know that was Gideon's lack of faith, not his faith doing that. But nevertheless, here he lays out these fleeces, and God, are you sure you're going to be with me? Are you sure you're going to be with me? Because I don't want to do this and be out there hanging out to dry. And God says, no, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to help you through this. And God calls him to then fight against the Midianites, which are innumerable. In fact, it says that the camels... I can't imagine that many camels, let alone having to feed them or at least give them enough water to drink. But the camels were innumerable. It's an amazing army that is now facing against them. And what does God tell Gideon about his army?
Too big.
I got about 22,000. Make it down. Let all the people that want to run, tell them to go ahead and leave. And, you know, you got about 12,000, just truck right out of there. And you're left at about 10,000, and now you've got these 10,000 people. And then he says, one more test, you still have too many people. Finally, he ends up with how many? 300 people, which is not a big group of people. And clearly, God makes it clear, I just want to let you know why I'm doing this, so that you guys wouldn't boast or brag in this victory. And they don't really even use guns or cannons or arrows or anything, do they? They just use pots and horns and stuff like this. But God is the one that confuses and brings confusion and causes the Midianites literally to kill off themselves. Do you remember how it ends? Because he actually gives a statement here, like at the rock of Oreb. You see that little phrase there? Why would he interject that little phrase? Anybody know how that... we probably need to go back to Judges, so let's just take a moment and go there. Well, no, that's not that one. But in Judges chapter 7, we'll just come towards the end in verse 24. It says, and Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim. This is Judges 7, verse 24. Saying, come down against Midian and take the waters before them as far as Beth Barah and the Jordan. So all the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they took the waters as far as Beth Barah and the Jordan, and they captured the two leaders of Midian. Oh, one of them name was Oreb. That's not like a vacuum cleaner. That's actually a guy's name. And they captured the two leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. And they killed Oreb where? At the rock of Oreb. And they killed Zeb at the wine press of Zeb. Which is telling us what? Why kill Oreb at the rock of Oreb? What would that seem to be?
His home,
his stronghold and monument to himself, and almost a sense of worship unto himself. His God of sorts, his strength of what he depended on. And so where is he going to be killed? At the very place in which he worships his God. How will the king of Assyria be killed?
By his own kids.
Where will he be?
In his own house.
At his place of worship.
Yeah.
At the place of his worship, he will be worshiping, and his own kids will kill him there as he is worshiping his God. So what is God telling us about the gods that we worship? Their history, and so are you. And I'm going to bring the demise of you both together. So be careful who you fear, because I'm going to bring you both down. The thing that you fear, the thing that you worship, will be snuffed out by me. because I'm going to bring everything into subjection. So you, here again, you want to be very careful what you we're going to be talking about, you know, how these parallel clearly as far as the things that we fear. Goes on and says, if we back up in Isaiah chapter 10, and the Lord of hosts will arouse a scourge against him like the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb, and his staff will be over the sea, and he will lift it up the way he did Egypt. Why would he give the analogy of Egypt, by the way? He's given an analogy of the time of Gideon. Now he's kind of given the analogy of the time of Egypt. Why is he given these two analogies, and why is he interjecting Egypt again at this point? Right.
That was his prime weapon throughout the, I mean, he used it as a snake, and it was a snake. He used it to touch the water. He used it to spread it out, out of the Red Sea.
It was weapon and direction, wasn't it? It was care and, so it was. So you think that God has given an analogy that I'm in control of the staff that's being used, and ultimately, I'm going to use it to protect you and to guide you safely through. It seems to be the point. And here again, I think bringing these analogies in, he's telling Judah all along, my hand has been on you. I've been protecting you all along. So nothing's new here. This is what I plan to do. This is what's going to happen. And I know you see these this great army converging on you. I know that you're little to nothing, but nevertheless, I'm going to hold them back. They're not going to mess with you. They're not going to touch you. Don't be afraid of them. Command. We drop on down to verse 27. So it will be in the day that his burden will be removed from your shoulders, his being the Assyrian burden, the threat, and his yoke from your neck, and the yoke will be broken because of fatness. It seems to convey that you're going to be strong enough to where you literally break it off. I'm just going to make you strong. I'm going to bless you. My blessing upon you, my strength upon you. Clearly, God's strength is made perfect in our weakness. And when we begin to realize that we need him, we begin to cry. And really, it was Hezekiah that came to the Lord, and he began to pray unto the Lord. And he says, because you prayed, I'm going to rescue you. Remember that as you get into Isaiah 36 and 37. Now, he takes up this, if I can put it this way, chant, song, prose that now begins to unfold before us. And if you look, all the letters at the beginning are capitalized. It's not necessarily the he is not necessarily referring to God because of that. It's just the capitalizing of the letters of the first line in each of these phrases. So I just want to let you know, because sometimes we mistake who he's talking about when you see something capitalized. Verse 28, he has come against Ith. Now, who is he at this point?
Assyrians.
The Assyrians. Yeah, it's the Assyrians, and more specifically, the ruler of Assyria, which will ultimately be in Sennacherib. But he has come against you. Now, we know what ultimately happens to him, because as he's attacking, what does God do? Sends an angel and wipes out 185,000, right? So God confuses them and wipes them out. And here again, all you have to do is go back to Isaiah 36 and 37. You can go to the Kings passage or the Chronicles passage, but in Isaiah 36 and 37, it unfolds too. He begins to explain and talk about his path, which if you follow these particular towns, it's like you're watching this great force come from the north and just press down right next to the doorstep of little Judah. So here you see in this army coming. And what is he doing? Well, he's coming. He's coming against Ith. He has passed through Migron. At Michmash, he's deposited his baggage, which seems to me, and that's pretty close, by the way, which seems to me that he's not only camping right at the door, but he's making himself at home. And it's his way of saying, you know, I'm here to stay. So you're not getting rid of me. And we can't imagine hundreds and hundreds of thousands. I mean, we send over 10,000, 30,000 troops, and that's just a mass of humanity to us. But if you could imagine 100, 200,000 warriors just camped against your little town, and it's an instant city. It's an instant city. that has to be built and has to be walled up, and they have all these machines that shoot things, whether it be huge rocks or boulders, and they're just building up this. And you can see them in the distance. You can see the dust stirring in the distance from the mass. You can hear the sound as the rumble of the horses and the camels begin to converge on you. And I can just imagine the fear that it would begin to stir in the hearts of man if, in fact, you were afraid of those kind of things. And we've oftentimes talked about the treachery of the Assyrians, which loved to impale people on a stick and, parade them around, who loved to burn people as alive, as they would drag them to the streets. So you can just picture in your mind this army coming that is treacherous, and there they're sitting at your doorstep and they're camping out. Now he uses particular towns that he has listed. So I told you one of the things we're going to do is we're just going to ask ourselves, well, what is this saying? Then we're going to ask ourselves, well, what does this mean? And we're going to try to derive the principle together. So let's just look at the towns that he begins to list. The towns that he begins to list, the first town seems to give an allusion to a number of things. One is we know that we're in the region of little Benjamin, which Benjamin is just kind of next door of Judah. So we know that the army is next door. We also know that this particular area, or this particular little town that is listed first, is one of the first places that Abraham builds an altar, as you see in Genesis chapter 12, where he's first called unto the Lord. And so it has kind of a connotation of God's people first coming in, and it's like this doorway of somebody coming in to God's house in his territory, claiming his land. And this is one of the reasons why he begins to use the towns that he has. If you look at the next one, it says that he has passed through Migron. You might want to list off to the side that in this particular place, by the way, anybody have any idea what Migron is or what little town that is? Once again, it's associated with a particular individual or a particular tribe. What tribe have we been talking about at this point? Benjamin. And Benjamin is where? Yeah, right next door. So you're just right there. And Judah is where we're coming to, and Judah is the place that God promised. I don't know if you've ever had things begin to happen to you, and it just seems like God just really gets way too close for comfort. But he seems to work this way. I mean, you go back to the children of Israel, and I think one of the reasons why he's talking about the whole staff thing is, didn't he tell them to camp by the water? He says, let's just camp there, because then Pharaoh will say, you guys are confused, and then he'll come after you. And it was like, well, God was clearly baiting Pharaoh. And I could just imagine the people, you know, standing by the water, can we just move on? You know, and God says, no, they haven't come yet. And the last thing they want to hear is that, you know, the Egyptians are coming. But that's the way God works, isn't it? So that we would not fear. Are you going to be afraid? Just like God turning, are you going to be afraid? No. I'm okay. So he has passed through Migron. Chapter 14 of 1 Samuel would give a picture of this particular place, and it is a place associated with Saul. And what do we know about King Saul? Pretty good king. The Chinese would say pretty rousy. And what we know about him is that though he looked real good, he didn't obey, nor did he seem to have the boldness that, say, King David did. There were a number of cases where his people would panic and he would panic too. This is a particular place where I think he's sitting by the pomegranate tree. And it is also a time in his life where the Philistines are gathering around. So God is associating and bringing us into to another time that would be parallel. Now, why does God do this parallel stuff? He goes like Egypt. He goes like the time of Midian. Why would he do that? All right, he wants to...
And you say the book to go back, you know, right? You tell somebody, right, it'd be like saying, well, the wind blew like Katrina.
Like, yeah. Like something that they can identify with.
When they talk about a tornado sounds like a freight train.
Right.
You know, so, you know,
I can relate to that. I know what a freight train is, right?
So,
right. Yeah. Any other reason?
I think it's the same thing he said, you know, to bring remembrance back. It's like in times in our own lives when we think back mm-hmm. about, you know, the things mm-hmm. God has done.
Right.
That we knew it had to be God because we certainly couldn't do it, and only God's hand could do that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he wants them to see it unfold, because when they see it unfold in that recognizable way, they have to say, this was not a mistake. This was not an act of a conspiracy. This was not an oops. This was not a perchance. This was the hand of God that made it unfold the exact same way. And the details of one of the things that Jesus tells his disciples, he says, all these things I've told you ahead of time, so that when it comes to pass, you might be comforted. And there's a certain comfort in things coming to pass exactly like God says. So when he says, don't be afraid, this is what's going to happen, then this is what's going to happen, and this is going to happen, but you're going to be okay. Well, if this happens, then this happens. I'm feeling pretty confident. I'm going to be okay, because it's just unfolding exactly like he said. So he's given great signs of comfort to them. And once again, his great emphasis is, I'm doing something here. And the great truth that God wants you to know is when he acts, there is no such thing as collateral damage. When he begins to move, he moves surgically. And it's hard to imagine. I mean, you see these massive amount of soldiers and bodies and camels and horses and chariots begin to come at you, and you go, I think there's going to be collateral damage. And he goes, no. I know those who are mine. I'm doing a surgical move here, and it's just going to go down just like this. The king's going to die at that place, at that time, and I'm going to work this. In fact, if you back up into Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 21, he says, a remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant within them will return. A destruction is determined, watch how he ends this, overflowing with righteousness. What he's identifying is, what I'm doing is perfectly, perfectly right. And I know those who are mine. You know, it's one of the great comforting passages in Timothy. The Lord knows those who are his, right? And I'm going to do, I think in this particular regard, one of the great parallel texts of this in the New Testament is found in 2 Peter chapter 2, which he gives that wonderful list of the different ones that God protected in the midst of destroying others. And he talks about Noah, and he said, well, if the Lord can destroy all those people but save Noah, if he can destroy Sodom and Gomorrah and save righteous Lot, if he can do these things, can't he take care simultaneously of the righteous and yet destroy the wicked at the same time? So he's letting us know that his hand is in this. You don't have to be afraid of anything. I mean, there are a lot of things in our life that we go, whoa, slow down. And God says, don't worry. I've got you covered. You're going to be okay. Hold my hand. I'm going to take care of you, and I'm not going to lose one. I can imagine just the great trepidation, and we know that the disciples had great trepidation before Christ went to the cross. Because he turns to them and he says, don't let your heart be troubled. But he also prays in John 17, I lose not one. So, great, great thing of comfort. So he begins to then give us these towns as we begin to see the Assyrian army just march a little bit closer, just a little bit closer. Quite frankly, we're getting a little uncomfortable that God is getting so allowing these people to get so close. He also uses the town of Michmash, which he begins to deposit his baggage, which is also found in 2 Samuel chapter 13, verse 5. Now here again is a picture of the immense battle, and at this particular time, and you would say, well, wait a minute, you're going 14 and then you're going back to 13. God's not interested in the chronological order of what happened in Samuel. What he is interested in is what those particular, the story that those particular things told. So the picture that you're getting is, first we see Saul, and he's sitting there, and he's a little concerned that things are going on. But in chapter 13, where we see Saul is impatient. Chapter 13 is at Michmash, right? And what's happening there? Well, he's supposed to wait for Samuel. Now, the armies are converging. Here the armies are converging. And what's happening to his soldiers? They're hightailing it. So, he's running out of soldiers. And he's supposed to wait for Samuel. And Samuel is what?
Late.
Yeah. God usually is late, according to your timing. I just want to let you know that. According to your timing, he's late. But God is not late. But here they are, and here he is. And so what does Saul decide he's going to do? Fear will cause you to give up on the waiting on God. I see many people ruin their lives because they just didn't wait one more hour. They didn't wait one more day. Couldn't wait one more week. They just couldn't wait on God. I've waited this long. Why don't you just finish it out? I mean, is God true or not? But the fear got the best of them. And fear causes people to stop waiting. Those who wait, I think it's in Isaiah, isn't it? Those who wait upon the Lord. Yeah. But that whole waiting thing. And so what we're getting here is a picture. Now, God in particular is literally jettisoning us back to the time of Saul, isn't he? Why would he be throwing us back into Saul when this isn't even a Saul thing? Except for the fact that it may be Saul's territory that the Assyrians are coming into. But why in particular is he bringing us into the whole scenario of unfolding of Saul? Yeah. And anything else with Saul? What not to do. Saul's a real good picture of what not to do. Yeah. Saul's a real good picture of somebody that didn't trust in God. In fact, one of the clear pictures I have of Saul is, finally Samuel says, look, the kingdom's going to be taken away from you. And Saul, and I'm going to basically paraphrase it, but Saul comes up to Samuel and he goes, say, Samuel, I know the king is going to be taken away from me, but do you think we could just have a shot here where I'm with the guys and it looks like I'm still in control? I mean, because Saul only seemed to care about how it looked. He really wasn't that interested in it really being true. It was just about appearance, and of course, his appearance was that which brought him the job. And so he was a good-looking man, and he's tall in stature, and everybody goes, boy, that guy looks like a king. And so then they made him a king. Big mistake, big mistake. Yeah, big mistake. Yeah, it's better to look good than to feel good. But that was a big mistake there. Verse 29, it then begins to drop down a little bit further. And they have gone through the pass saying, Geba will be our lodging place. Do you remember a particular story of the pass? You've been going through this, haven't you? That's where one of our favorite guys became a hero. Yeah. And it's in this particular pass, once again, the Philistines are gathered, and Saul's at the point where he's frozen. But Jonathan goes into it. But Saul's not doing anything. Now Saul, this is the irony of fear. Fear will cause you not to wait on God, right, but will cause you to do nothing and be frozen in things that you should be doing. I've often heard people say, well, I'm just waiting on God, I'm just waiting on God, when the truth of the matter is they're just doing nothing because they're afraid to move. There are certain things that God is telling you to do while you're waiting. Obey God in your waiting. That waiting doesn't mean you sit at home and twiddle your fingers. It means obey God as you're waiting. Do what he tells you to do. Things that you know to do right. Here again we see one of the great examples of Saul in his inability to obey God and trust in him. He then uses the town Ramah, is terrified. Now Ramah was Saul's hometown. So it's telling us that, Saul is terrified, and Gibeah of Saul has fled away. Now, I just want to let you know where Gibeah, or what Gibeah is. Gibeah is where he gathered all of his valiant men together to stand alongside of him. That's where they had their group picture. And, they did this pose number, to where they looked really strong. But these were the guys that didn't do anything when the giant came along. See? But they looked pretty strong. And they're pretty ominous looking, but that was about it, just for the photo shoot. But what he's saying is his hometown, Saul is shaking in his boots, and so are his valiant men. So, yes, sir. Good point. We're getting close. Too close for comfort. Too close for comfort. And we're actually going to get a little bit closer, because now we're going to drop on to verse 30. And the declaration of verse 30 is, "Cry aloud with your voice, O daughter of Galem." Now, daughter seems to point to the fact that we're focusing on not a man but a woman. So that's kind of an obvious thing. Would anybody care to venture? Who in the world are we talking about? Anybody want to jump on in there? Daughter of Galem. Well, you're going to see some familiar names here. Pay attention, Lesha, and wretched, and I know that the King James has another translation of that, Anathoth. Madmenah has fled. So let's look at some of these words. Daughter of Galem, Lasha. Well, let's look at some of those. And let's turn to 1 Samuel chapter 25. We'll just read one verse, and we'll read in particular this last verse of this chapter. Now Saul had done something. What did he do? What did Saul do? Who was that to? He was a son of who? Oh, where was he from? Oh. So daughter of would be referring to who? Daughter of would be who? Right. And what do we know about her? Great wife?
No.
What was she like? Encouraging? Yeah, you're embarrassing me. Please, stop. You can't be dancing that way, right? We would say she derided him. We would say that she held him in contempt, and was clearly anything but a loving, encouraging wife, and then ultimately ends up marrying this one, which here again is in Benjamin. It's like in your face. It's like in your face before David. And Saul was doing this on purpose. Saul was literally taunting David by doing this. Saul was doing this on purpose. Why would he be taunting God's anointed? That doesn't make sense. Well, let's go on and read. His statement here is you need to cry with your voice, O daughter of Galem. Why would he tell the daughter to be crying? Because that particular region, once again, we're getting a little bit closer. And with that one step closer, He is also saying, I just want to let you know the Assyrians are going here too. They're coming into your town too, O daughter. They're going to hit you too. He goes on a little bit further, and he says, pay attention. And, of course, the household that she wed to is going to be swallowed up too by Assyria. It's as if God's saying, I'm going to get everybody that was going against his... Right. So he makes a statement, pay attention, and you wretched of Anathoth. So let me just say this. Anathoth was actually a town that was set aside for the Levites in the tribe or area of the Benjamites. They seemed to be priests that at that juncture seemed to be bought off by Saul, not the ones helping David. There will be a priest that helps David, but not these. We know that ultimately God will give this particular town as a sign to Jeremiah. And by the way, this is a town where Jeremiah is actually from. And he'll say, buy some land there because I'm going to redeem it back. But at this juncture, the emphasis is, I'm going to rid this town of all you people who literally pulled out the rug under my anointed and did it to his face. And we almost see this precision, this surgical operation of God just going one by one, I'm going to get you, I'm going to get you, I'm going to get you. And he just keeps, and then here's the Assyrian army. And the Assyrian army going, wow, this is a lot easier than I thought. I mean, that's one of the things that they had stated earlier. This is pretty easy. This is going to be a cinch. We didn't think it was going to be this easy. He says, cry aloud. And then he ends in verse 31. Medmenna has fled. Those are basically the dunghill beds in that particular region, which seems to refer to the people as well as the places in which they're fleeing. If you look at the inhabitants of Gibbon, and here again you're getting a little bit closer, but that particular word means the ditches. And so we see them hiding in the dunghills, we see them hiding in the ditches. They're any place that they can hide, they're running. And he says, that's where you belong. It's kind of what he's saying. And it's in a nice way, I'm sure. The inhabitants have sought refuge. They're hiding. They're hiding under rocks and everything they can. Yet he ends in this way, verse 32. Yet he will halt at Nob. What happened at Nob? Yes, sir.
That's where David was hiding with the priests, and Doug the Edomite came and slayed all the priests.
How was David taken care of there? Right. Remember, Jesus actually makes mention of this. Didn't even Jesus eat the consecrated bread? Right. And it was this particular priest that actually rescued David. And didn't he give him a sword or something? Yeah, Goliath's sword at that particular point. Now, Saul later finds out David was there because he was betrayed. And the priests are slaughtered, right? Remember the particular scene. But Saul is foiled again. Foiled again. Just can't get his hands on that guy. He's a slippery goose. Every time he tries to find him, he there he is and he's gone. And what's he going to do? He begins to shake his fist at him. Curses. I'm going to get you. How's it end, by the way, in verse 32? So a picture is being painted here. Picture is being painted. So what we've done, we've kind of just, okay, what does it say? I just told you what it says. What does it mean by what it says? What is the principle here? Why is he telling us this? Yes. Go ahead.
They ends with them shaking their fists at the place that symbolizes the Lord's rule on earth.
And God protecting his anointed. There was certainly a desire to snuff out God's anointed, and it was going to be thwarted. And it was as if God, I mean, you see God going, you're going to be out, you're going to be out, you're going to be out, we're going to stop here. And they're going to shake their fist. They're going to want to come further, but I'm not going to let them come any further. So I mean, we're just hanging maybe 3 kilometers away. We're just, you know, dangling. I mean, there they are. We can see them. We're actually probably on the other side of the Mount of Olives. We can see them, but they can't come any further.
Did you say they're up to their neck?
They're up to their neck. It's understood that Nob is actually just on the other side of the Mount of Olives, ancient Nob. So there's a principle for us. Now, what I want you to do is conjoin the principle with the issue of fear, because he's telling us something about fear. He says, don't be afraid. And he's also painting a picture, and he's telling a story. So what is it he's telling us? What is it he doesn't want us to do? What is it he doesn't want the nation of Judah to do? What's the lesson? What's the principle? Give me a principle of the passage. Yes, sir.
Don't fear man and the things they can do. Put our trust in the Lord.
All right. What does fear do to us?
Make us
fear causes panic.
It does cause panic. He's telling his people not to fear. Saul was his people. Saul feared, didn't he? Yes. It does cause you to reject God. I mean, why is fear so treacherous? Why is it that God says you cannot fear anything else? I mean, look. I'm going to tell you unequivocally, and I know I repeated this probably a number of times last week, but whatever you fear, you're worshiping. And I know it's hard to swallow that. But whatever you're afraid of is that which you worship. Now, why would I say that? What would be that which conveys that truth? All right. But. All right, so immediately what fear does is it, I mean, where are your thoughts? Won't it be in Isaiah 26, thou will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee because he trusts in thee. So where your mind is, isn't it in Philippians chapter 4, be anxious for nothing. Then does he go on and tell you what you should be focusing on? Whatsoever things are good, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, think on these things, and the God of peace will guard your mind and your heart in Christ Jesus. You're going to say something. That's what fear acknowledges, and that's a good point. Fear acknowledges that there's something greater wherever. So that's why fear ultimately will lead to worship. Fear held on to will ultimately to worship. Why? Right. The one who controls the serpent rather than the serpent itself. That doesn't mean don't get out of the way, because Scripture says flee. But allowing that to begin to become a part of our thoughts, taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, allowing that to become a part of our thoughts is, you know, thinking about it, fearing about it, you know, is that which leads us to a worship of it, because what we're giving that thing or that person is the control of our thoughts, and also we're acknowledging you're more powerful, not just than us, than God. Because if we believe that God is for us, then we have to say, well, who can be against us? So if we begin to see this force as more powerful, then we're denying the power of God, aren't we? All right, so that's I would say it was a basic fundamental truth that it brings us to a sense of worship. Also the fact that you can interject in there, as was so aptly put, fear causes your attention and your thoughts to be on that. It demands that you think about it. You just, I mean, whatever you're afraid of, you just can't stop thinking about it, right? I mean, that's why it's so crucial. You cannot be afraid of anything because it demands this. Yes. Well, yes and no. You're right, ultimately, that it brings us to reverence. But the fear actually is translated also terror, and will be expanded into you need to dread God. The reason here, again, is that which we fear is that which we end up worshiping. Now, then God will turn to us and he says, be not afraid. But you and I need to have a sense of awe. In fact, the very same word where he says, do not be afraid here in Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 24 is going to be used in chapter 11 in talking about the fear of the Lord. Very same word. So there has to be this sense of you are far greater than anything else. And that since reverence comes out of a sense, and this is why they're so tied together. I mean, there has to be, you and I, in 1 Peter is very clear, that if God impartially judges, you and I need to walk in fear before him. Hebrews will tell us, if in fact we have this grace upon us, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? I think grace should stir in our heart a greater fear because of the fact that his kindness is being spat upon. And it's one thing to kick somebody in the knee. It's another thing to crucify them. And I would say going against the law was one thing, but crucifying grace is quite another thing. How shall we escape if we know and trample underfoot the grace of God? And so the great emphasis is, and there's much emphasis in the New Testament about us having this great sense of fear, because that's what brings us to our knees. That's what causes me to say, I can't believe you would rescue me. If you don't have that sense of fear, I mean fear, trepidation, shaking, then God touches you with his grace and he says, be not afraid. But that's what brings me to my knees. And that can never be, look, I don't think in all of eternity we'll come to the point where we go, you know, I'm getting pretty comfortable with this guy. I mean, creator of all things and heaven's thunder and move, and you know, it's just going to be a miraculous thing. But knowing that he loves us is that which is going to bring a sense of excitement with that sense of fear and awe and respect, which ultimately comes with that. So we have this. We have these things that we're afraid of, which he says, you're not allowed to do this. Why are we not allowed to do this? Because you can't be thinking about this stuff. Why can't I think about this stuff? Because the more you think about this stuff, the more you begin to worship it, the more it begins to take control. Now, what he's also going to tell you is this, that everything associated with those things begin to have great value to you. Everything not associated with those things have little value to you. Now, where do I get that from? Well, what you begin to see with Saul is all things that were associated with the things that he was afraid of began to be the focus of his attention. But the things that were not began to be diminished in his sight, David being one of them. And David's not important. Why? He's not afraid of David. He care less, and he's not afraid of David's God. Not afraid of the true God. What he is afraid of is these armies that are coming. Now, the best example I can give you is my wife, because she hates spiders. And I said, honey, it's pretty interesting that you see a spider on the floor, and immediately I become unimportant, unless it's to step on it. because she's going to say, out of my way, and she's going to go. And I don't know where I fly or where anybody else flies, but the only thing on her mind is getting out of the path of that spider. See? What that statement is that fear makes everything else unimportant, of great value. We know that depression is a result of anxiety. Is that true? Much of depression. And that anxiety, of course, anxiety is a form of fear, right? Being anxious for nothing. I'm just so afraid, and that just builds within inside, and you just introvert it to death, and we just compress it, and then all kinds of problems. I don't get into the psychobabble that's involved with that. But the bottom line is you have this fear, and it's stirring within inside of you, and it's causing all of this depression and sorrow. And have you ever seen the advertisement, Who Does Depression Hurt? Have you ever seen that one? There's an advertisement for the new wonder drugs that are out there. It's a medical problem. But there's a new wonder drugs out there. And it starts off and it says, who does depression hurt? It says, everybody. And it shows this person, they're sad, and they can't talk to this person. They can't talk to that person. They can't relate to their family. They can't socialize with anybody. Because why? Because the depression, the thing, whatever it is, that's bringing this on, has taken such precedence that everything else is insignificant. Everything else is useless and worthless. You might have loved ones going, but we love you. Doesn't matter that you love me, because this is what's important to me. This has taken priority in my life. And you begin to throw away all the things of great value for the sake of the one thing. I say that's what fear does. It focuses on that thing and all the things that are associated with it. Yes?
Well, what I gathered from here is, like, say you become afraid of something, like, I'm afraid of needles or anything that can hurt me. And so you become afraid of that. And so then you at first, if you start out as just like, oh, that could hurt me, I should be afraid of that. And then I remember that fear the next time I see it, and it builds on itself. And then I start doing anything I can to avoid being put into a situation where that could hurt me. Mm-hmm. And then it takes control over me.
It builds on itself.
Yeah, it builds on, and so then that I'm giving
just,
it power.
Just builds on itself.
Possible,
it just does it by that. Itself. It just
yeah, so
grows by itself. And it grows by itself. How does it grow? You're watering the garden. You're hanging around. You're dwelling on it. You're giving it precedence. You're lifting it up and you're saying, oh, worshipful needle, how important thou art. I must think about you today more. But our thoughts begin, and then, yes, it does. God has not given us a spirit of fear, timidity. The spirit begins to take over, doesn't it? It's just like alcohol. One of the reasons I think it's called spirits is because it takes over. There's a spirit that begins to take over. And Scripture says, well, God's not given us a spirit it's dissipation that causes to. God's called upon it. Look, the will of the God is not that you be filled with that spirit, but that you be filled with His spirit. That you think on Him. That God will keep us in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on Thee, because He trusts in Thee. Did I see hand up back here? Yes. Uh-huh. No.
Fears that I would, they're just silly, when you think of them, they are not as real as
Right.
Now, that is freedom.
Right. And our God, who is over all gods, loves us. Now, if we don't see him on the throne, if we don't see him far greater than all of the gods, then that love is not going to take on significant meaning in our hearts. But when we see this one that is for us, then who can be against us? And we have great confidence and we have great boldness, and there is no fear. Well, doesn't he say this in 1 John? Perfect love casts out fear, because our love that has come from God has no judgment with it. And we begin to realize if God is not judging us, then nothing will. And if God is only wanting good for us, then nothing can hurt us. And this is why Paul can rejoice when he's in prison as well as when he's out. He can rejoice wherever he's in or whatever circumstance he's in, because he knows that God is causing these things to work together for his good. It's such a wonderful peace, isn't it, to know that? There's a passage in Psalms 34, if you'll turn there with me. What am I doing on time? Oh, run out of time. Psalms 34. I will bless the Lord at all times. And I have found when I'm busy blessing, I just can't be afraid of anything. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make its boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear and rejoice. Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord and he answered me, and he delivered me from all my fear. The word fear there is a little bit different than the ones that we've seen in the past. It has this connotation of stuff that I've held on to. It's like abiding fears. You know, stuff that's made itself home with me. Stuff that I've made a part of my life. He says he's taken it all away. We all have comfortable fears. We have things that we feel like we have the right to be afraid of. And God says, no, none of them. I'm going to take them all away. He delivered me from all my... They looked to him and were radiant. Their faces shall never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he rescues them. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Oh, fear the Lord, you his saints, for to those who fear him there is no want. I think it's very important that whatever you're afraid of, you lay it aside. I mean, you want the blessings of God. You want the blessing. Take whatever you're afraid of. Bring it before the Lord and say, I'm not going to be afraid of that anymore, because you're over that. I believe you're over that. And Scripture tells me, those who fear the Lord, there's no want. He'll take care of you. I think one of the reasons why the hand of the Lord, I don't know how, and I know some of you are going to say, he's going to be late. And he is going to be late according to your time. But the Lord's going to be perfect in his timing in your life. And when he unfolds it, it's going to be glorious. And you're going to go, wow, I never thought I'd see Lazarus being raised from the dead, but I did. And it was certainly worth the wait, wasn't it? He says, but you who seek the Lord shall not be in want of any good thing. Come, you children, listen to me. I'm going to teach you something. What is he going to teach us how to do? Verse 11. Fear the Lord. Who is the man who desires life, loves the length of days, that he may see good? Well, keep your tongue from evil, your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil, do good, seek peace, pursue it. In other words, a person that fears the Lord is going to do the right thing. You and I should be more afraid of doing the wrong thing than we should of anything else out there. That's what should disturb you. That's what you should be afraid of. Instead, we could care less that, I did it in secret, nobody saw it, nobody. Then you're fearing the wrong stuff. And it's no wonder we're in trouble. But the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, his ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against evildoers, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. Righteous cry, the Lord hears. He delivers them out of all their trouble. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted. He saves those who are crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous. Doesn't say you're not going to have them. But he does say he's going to deliver you out of them all. He leaves all his bones, not one of them is broken. Evil shall slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the soul of his servants, and none of those who take, none, did you get that? None of those who take refuge in him will be held guilty. And Romans will say, will be disappointed. None of them will be disappointed. So, you know, it's a great truth. Let me just tell you that there are some fundamental principles in this particular passage. One is that the fear is the foundation of worship. Fear demands our attention and our thoughts, so you don't want to even get into it. And fear diminishes the significance of those things that is associated with the object of fear. That is to say, are not associated with the object of fear. So everything that is not associated with these things, then it sees as unvaluable. And so everything that is associated with these things is going to start taking precedence. Let me just say this, and I got to say it. I get on the soapbox all the time, but it's my soapbox. So I'll cry if I want to. But this whole health care, why is everybody crying about that? What are you upset about? If I get it, fine. If I don't, fine. I don't care. That's not my hope. That's not my trust. My hope and my trust is in the Lord. That's where our hope and trust is. What this government is doing, they're not doing anything, look, that the Assyrian army hadn't planned to do. But they're only going to go as far as God says, and they're not going to go past Nob. And he's going to turn to them and he says, don't touch my anointed. And they're not going to touch him. The big question is, who are you afraid of? Because Saul was a part of that kingdom. But Saul suffered loss because he worshipped the God of fear and began to be used by that God. Let me say this one other thing about fear. Fear will always cause you to be treacherous. Fear of anything but God will always cause you to be treacherous towards others. Because that fear will take precedence. And you'll see those other people as getting in the way of your protection. But if you fear God, you'll begin to love others the way that you should. So, fear is a very treacherous thing if it's not based in God. And Saul shows us that in the way that he responds time and time again. And fear taunts God's anointed. It will not bless God's anointed. It will not encourage God's anointed. It will taunt it. And God says, I'm going to swallow you up too. So I certainly don't want to be on the side of those who bring fear or those who worship that fear. And this is why God says you cannot fear the Assyrians. Father, we come before you tonight and we give you thanks that you're in control, that you're the God that is using these sticks in our life to get our attention. But your plan for us is good. You're doing good in our life. And we will not be afraid. For our hope is in you. But we will seriously feel great trepidation if we step out of line. Because, Lord, the last thing we want to do is displease the Lord of glory. So, Lord, help us to keep that healthy fear within our hearts and know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Great One, the God of all gods, the Lord of lords, the King of glory, loves us. I give you thanks in Jesus' name.